Greetings from the Southern Cohort of the 2019 UC Coro System-Wide Leadership Collaborative. Our cohort project is entitled Best Practices for Leading Campus System-Wide Change Projects. And our deliverables include the production of podcast interviews with influential people in the area of change management, theory, and applications. My name is Daniel Jeske, the Vice Provost for Administrative Resolution and a Professor of Statistics at the University of California, Riverside. I am joined in this interview by my cohort colleagues, Colin DeMock, Assistant Vice Chancellor of Environment, Health, and Safety at UCLA, Zavini Khan Marcus, Director of the Multicultural Center and the Division of Student Affairs at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and Brandon Rhodes, Chief of Staff of the Office of the Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. Our guest in this interview is Dr. Brent Rubin. Dr. Rubin is a distinguished professor of communication. His home department at Rutgers University is the Department of Communication, situated within the School of Communication and Information. Dr. Rubin is the founder and executive director for the Center of Organizational Leadership at Rutgers University. His academic career has been devoted to advancing interdisciplinary and systemic approaches to the study of communication and the application of these frameworks in cross-cultural, health, educational, organizational, and leadership contexts. He is the author of more than 50 books and 135 journal articles in these areas. Maybe we could get started, Brent, by you telling us a little bit about your background and experience with change management.
I've been at Rutgers for quite a few years. I actually came to Rutgers as part of a small team that was designed around starting a new school of communication. It was from sort of that point that I started thinking a lot about organizational change in higher education, because we had a plan for how we were going to approach the creation of a new school, and we thought it would take about 5 years. It actually took about 20 years. And that was my first sort of brush with reality about change in higher education. And since that time, I've been studying the higher education change and leadership quite a bit, and also looking and being involved with healthcare institutions and change that they're undergoing as well. And for the past 20 years, I've directed something called the Center for Leadership Development.
Could you talk a little bit about the goals and the mission of your center?
Yes, we have a few different functions, but I think most germane to this conversation is that we're kind of an internal consulting arm, and we are available to leaders, and it's generally through leaders that we work to help conceive of and plan and implement change initiatives. Our longer-term goal is really to build capacity within the units and within the leadership so that they're able to do this sort of thing themselves.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe your situation at Rutgers as having, like, it's a campus with a centralized change management office?
Yes and no. We are a centralized office for that, but yet there are other places where support for change management occurs. There's several people who work on what they call change management in the finance area, and I think they have a more technical approach to the way they think about it. Their focus, I think, is on resources and training and technology. So when a new platform is to be brought in for purchasing or something, they call that change management. I think our specialization is more on the people side and the communication culture piece. We work with the unit where the content expertise lies.
We hear a lot about the people side of change management as we've read some of the literature, including some of your papers. We were wondering what that really means to you, the people side of change management.
Well, I think in much of the writing about change management and in much of the sort of folklore, there's this view that when people talk about change management, they're thinking mostly about the technical part of it and the training part of it and the resources needed. And there's a tendency to think that those are the key success factors, and also when there are failures or shortfalls in the change initiative, to attribute them to lack of attention to those sorts of things. But I think actually the people side, which I consider to be domain of communication issues and cultural issues in particular, that oftentimes, I think most often, it's inattention or inappropriate attention to communication and culture that probably are more responsible for failures of change than anything on the more technical resource or training side.
Is that also then what makes the difference between corporate and higher education challenging?
Yes, I think it definitely is more challenging to bring about and promote change in higher education for a number of reasons. Certainly one of them is that we have far few carrots and sticks available to us as leaders than are typically present in the corporate world. You know, if you're in a corporation, you can decide we want to do this new initiative or this new merger, or this acquisition, and we're going to throw a fair amount of money at it. We're going to bring in some people whose sole position involves bringing this about, seeing it through. We'll pay big bonuses for their success, and everybody who contributes to that will be duly rewarded. You know, we're just not able to do that in higher education. And so it turns out that leading change in higher ed is so much dependent on the issues of communication, not only of getting the message out, but also listening very carefully to the people who need to buy into the change that you're promoting, but also then culture and figuring out how to assess the culture you're dealing with, and to the extent possible, how to kind of go with the flow of the culture. You have to be concerned about those things in the corporate world, but I think that it's more of an elective choice that you might make. In higher ed, I think there's no choice if you want to be successful, but to pay a great deal of attention to those factors.
Because of the strong drive for having a voice and shared governance kind of structures, maybe change goes more slowly.
Absolutely. It goes more slowly, and the general traditions of academic freedom, which aren't solely operating on the academic side, I think they affect to some degree the administrative culture in universities as well, means that things do take longer. And it also means that people expect to be more autonomous and don't necessarily feel as though people should be telling them what to do. And that particularly, I think, is so on the academic side.
Colin wanted to ask Dr. Rubin about two distinct types of change.
In some of the other discussions I've had, we've talked about two types of change, the types of change that need to come down from the top directly and don't have some more flexibility, and those types of change where you have the ability, say, to work with the groups and try and build up that expectation throughout the organization. Can you speak a little bit to those two types?
I understand the distinction there, but I would tend to view it not as dichotomy, but more or less as a continuum. You still, I think, need to put some significant attention to helping people understand why the change is needed. It could be very easy to think, well, this is a change that has to happen, so therefore we're not really going to spend much time worrying about engaging people in the discussion of the whys or giving them the history or telling them what other schools are doing or that sort of thing, because it's going to happen anyway. It creates an unnecessary hostility toward administration if there's not a bit of a collaborative approach taken.
Zavini turned the discussion towards communication skills used throughout the change management process.
What is the most important aspect of communication during a change process?
I guess I would say that it be two-way. People say we need more communication, and they usually mean by that we need to tell people more about what it is we think they should do, why it is we think they should do it. But I think in change initiatives, the more important or equally important part is the listening part of it. And that actually needs to come first.
Stephen Covey's quote, "Seek first to understand, then to be understood," seems relevant here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's not necessarily something that translates all that easily into one's behavior.
What is the best strategy for recognizing and dealing with resistance to change?
Well, first of all, you have to prepare for the reality that there will be resistance. Leaders should not be taking it personally. I think another thing is that you really be open to listening to it and hearing it out, because sometimes in the resistance, there are really helpful messages. There's a book, A Complaint is a Gift. I think I've got the title right. It's really counterintuitive, but if you've got somebody who's got the courage to speak out and raise a concern, they probably are reflecting a point of view of many other far more fearful and reticent people in the room who aren't sharing that perspective with you outwardly. So I think you almost need to develop the perspective that it is a gift when someone will tell you what their concerns are. What we know from communication theory is allowing people to share what's on their mind lessens their resistance no matter what. Another dimension of this is that when people see that leaders will listen to them and listen to their colleagues, the respect for leadership goes up and the credibility of what the leaders are proposing also goes up, and the willingness to accept the suggestions of leaders regarding the change also goes up.
I remember in an earlier conversation we had, you mentioned when a senior leader is talking to a group of people about a change and being asked tough questions, maybe fielding complaints and sensing resistance, that the people are watching that leader carefully to see how he responds or she responds. And the respect for that leader is on the line at that moment.
Absolutely. And in fact, next week I'm doing a retreat for the senior leadership, all the senior leadership of the health and medical school area. And the topic is going to be difficult conversations, which is a topic they requested. It's going to be a morning workshop on this. And one of the points that we're going to make, and we got some case studies and role playing we're going to do, is that, you know, just those situations where you're being critiqued by a group, you're trying to present some new initiative that you think is great, some new merger, some new program, and you've got a whole group challenging you. You know, how do you handle something like that? Realizing that that the key audience for that might not just be the people who are challenging you, but even more so, it's everybody else who's going to be the witness to how you handle it. As a leader, you're going to be the role model, hopefully, for how they should handle similar situations, but also you're kind of creating your leadership brand or identity or credibility through the way that you handle these things in the eye of others. The way it can be handled really well, just as an example, that is a merger that we had underway, a significant merger of a couple units, and there were many students that were distraught and many faculty that were distraught about it. We're in the initial stages of the president was trying to convey what was the perceived rationale, the need for doing this, and there were a couple hundred people in the room, and there were some real activist type people who started speaking out and speaking over the president. And, you know, really trying to disrupt the meeting, I would say. And what he did, and it was so skillful, I thought, was to stop the meeting and say, I understand that a number of you have real genuine concerns, and I want to hear those concerns, and I want to give you the opportunity to share those with me. What I would ask, though, is you let me share my remarks with you and the group, and then I will stay as long as you want and listen to your concerns and take down all the points that you want to make and make sure they're fully considered. He didn't get defensive. He was up in the front of the podium with a pad of paper and just listened and made notes. Oftentimes he said, you know, I don't have the answer to that. It's an important point you've raised. I will check and get an answer. And if you'll let me know how to reach you, I'll get back to you with that answer.
How does one go about determining the necessary resources to implement a proposed change?
Talk carefully with the various constituencies involved. The people who will need to do the training, the people who will need to be the implementers. I think there's so often a tendency to sit on high and try to work out all these details without engaging the people who are on the ground who often know the details that leaders might not. So I would just try to engage constituencies, experts in the constituencies, in the resource determination process.
What is a reliable mechanism for handling unexpected circumstances that arise during a change process, which I would think, you know, it's something to expect overall?
I think the best key here is to have developed a really effective operating and steering committee that probably has reputation from the various stakeholders and that meets regularly and kind of surveys and monitors the process. It's probably this group that I would recommend should keep track of whatever metrics you have about how the process is going and kind of monitors resistance. And then when there are unanticipated developments, this group is pretty well prepared to deal with the situation, bringing to bear all the different information that might be available.
What are viable strategies for a campus or the UC system when managing simultaneous changes?
You remember the I Love Lucy show at all? Any of you?
Yes.
So what you have is Lucille Ball and Ethel decided to take a job as candy wrappers in an assembly line. And the assembly line is before them. They're standing there and the candy's coming down the line, the chocolates, and they're supposed to wrap each one up, each piece of chocolate put in a box. And for a little while, things are going well. And then the assembly line speeds up and there seem to be more chocolates on it. And they're having a hard time keeping up. And then they eventually start trying to eat a few of the chocolates and they put a few of the chocolates down their dress, on their hat. And, you know, and they become completely exasperated. The management comes in and looks and all they see is, well, you know, they seem to be keeping up, you know, and they don't see the various diversionary forms that this keeping up has required. So they increase the rate of process even more. And so you see quality's been compromised, morale's been compromised. When I've used this, everyone sort of laughs and nods. And there's one more kind of thing I've done to illustrate what I think is the issue here, where someone is getting up from a wave, and then just as they're on their feet, another wave hits them, and they fall down again. And then just as they get up from that wave, yet another wave hits. You see the person become literally exhausted and never really gain the resiliency from one arising to deal with the next wave. And I think those are the challenges of too much change at one time. But I think the way to deal with that is with some sort of a template that has all these projects on it and keeps track of which stage each project is at. And realizing that you want to sequence these, you need to prioritize these. And if you don't pay some attention to that sequencing and management at a macro level, then it turns out many of these change initiatives might fail and some might grind to a halt altogether.
I was wondering if there are some telltale signs that the organization is experiencing too many or too prolonged series of changes. Are there things to watch for?
I think you need for each change initiative some kind of a change initiative coordinating committee that is unique for that project and composed of individuals who represent different levels within the organizations that are affected, all the way from administration to lower level workers, perhaps. If you have that group and you have trust within that group, and one of the questions that you raise with people, particularly at the lower levels of the organization, is sort of how is this going, is probably the best way to do it. I don't know how you really get at it with the survey, and I think it's difficult in a town hall meeting or something where a senior leader said, so how is this going? Because people are very reticent about sharing their true views if they don't think that it'll be well received.
Brandon asked Dr. Rubin about tips for recognizing when projects should be delayed or possibly canceled.
I'm curious about your thoughts on whether you have signs or signals that a change project might need to be postponed or canceled altogether.
A problem is that the higher you go in the organization, the less you see the chaos that results at lower levels with things going on. Staying in touch with those that are doing the implementation and creating an open environment where people can be candid, and then being very realistic at the top about what truly are the priorities and what is the sequence of those priorities. The telltale signs are in what people are talking about over coffee and, you know, at lunch at lower levels of the organization.
You'd spoken a little bit about having a macro level change document and individualized micro level ones. Could you talk to me a little bit about the methods you use to track the changes?
We have a template that we've converted to sort of a step-by-step guide that talks about five stages of the change process for each initiative. That's one axis of the matrix. And the other axis is, what do you do about communication at each stage? What do you do about leadership at each stage? And what do you do about planning at each stage? So you have this 5x5 matrix. Then each cell becomes an opportunity for a given initiative to fill out by a coordinating team or by the people involved. What is the activity that needs to go on in there? Then we just take a macro version of that. One axis of this macro matrix is the stages. The other axis is the listing of the projects that are underway at the same time. And you can use dates in the cells there. When did initiative A get started? What stage is it in now? And you can plan, when is it going to move to another stage? You can pretty quickly see if you've got way too much going on and it's not well sequenced, and there are points of time where there's too much or where there's really nothing going on. So that's the macro level planning matrix that can kind of grow out of the individual project matrices.
That's certainly something we could use on our campus for sure, as we go through a number of changes here in integrating and building facilities and building out our networks and launching new schools. That sounds exactly what we're looking for.
Tools like that are really helpful because in a certain way they're commonsensical, but they bring structure and they're a way of combining all the key dimensions to think about. And in the end, after having been through a process using this kind of model, then people can, you know, maybe depart from that model in subsequent changes that they might oversee. And you now have people who have enhanced capacity to smartly think about managing change.
Yeah, I think that developing that shared language is also helpful for having multiple projects. People get used to seeing the same cells, the same kind of language. I like the idea of that kind of common thread throughout all the different change projects.
I've read, I think, in some of your writings about how choice of language is very important to understand what some types of words might mean to one group versus another group. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. And the academic side is far more sensitive to words than the administrative side. But business talk generally does not go so well. Performance assessment, for example, you know, we hear that being talked about more in the academic side. You know, people's hackles just go up immediately, faculty members. Performance assessment, who's qualified to assess that? Or talking about students as customers. Management's another one.
How about training?
Training we never use. Many years ago at Berkeley, I was younger and less informed about such things. And I talked about training and education. And a very senior faculty member said, training is for animals. Now, staff are far less sensitive, in my experience, to particular terms, and staff are far less likely to see their own units as wholly unique and special in the ways that faculty do. These are really cultural concerns that might vary from university to university. So the deal is that when you're managing change, a particular initiative, you really want to know what words are going to resonate in what kinds of ways with the groups that you need support from. There have been times where strategic planning has been overdone as a phrase around institutions I've been involved with. So you want to do something that really is strategic planning, but why don't you call it identifying a vision for the future instead of saying we're going to do strategic planning. People say, well, what do you mean vision for the future? You get a chance to reinvent what you're talking about without people having an immediate knee-jerk reaction of, oh my God, not another strategic planning exercise that goes nowhere.
So we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but you mentioned your workbook, and I have to say it was extremely valuable to our CORO project team as we worked through case study analysis of past projects. And I think we could easily see how for active projects it would equally serve a great purpose. But could you talk more generally about best current practices and other templates, and what's the status of tools like templates and best current practices that might be applicable for change management?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm in the best position to comment on those, except to say there's certainly lots and lots of talk right now about change management, many, many consultants on change management. I know there are some various tools out there. Various consultants have done a pretty good job of marketing those. And, you know, I'll be here, or I'll be there, and someone said, are you familiar with this or that model? And I'll say, well, I've heard of it, but, you know, I'm not really conversant with the details of too many of those. We got so many things going on that I've really focused on the development of ours over time. There's a lot of commonality, you know, across these. Any model or any template you use, I think, needs to take account of the fact that there are various stages that the change needs to go through. And it also needs to take account of the various kinds of key success factors. And I think it needs to take account of engaging people from the various stakeholder groups.
In statistics, we sometimes have different techniques and we wonder like which one to use. And sometimes we say, you know, it's really just better that you're using one of them than it is to worry so much about which one.
Yeah. The more that you can stick with something and create a common understanding and familiarity across different units so that a facilities unit can talk to, you know, a music department and so that one institution can talk to another. That's probably the most important thing, more important than the specific nature of the tool.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, we have found your workbook extremely helpful to us as we work through case studies, and we'll be telling you more about that as we conclude those efforts. You can maybe see more how we actually benefited from that. So thank you for that. And also for your time today, we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and share a little bit of what we're trying to learn about. And you've answered a lot of our questions, given us a lot of good insight.
It's been a pleasure, you know, to interact with you today and previously, and I have a great deal of respect for the amount of effort that you putting into trying to get on top of this, as opposed to maybe just going out there and grabbing onto some consultant or someone, not really thinking through the conceptual issues, because I do think that the tools you pick are really far less important than the approach to the concepts at a more general level.
Okay, great. Then with that, we'll close the meeting. And again, many thanks, and thanks to my colleagues for joining.
Nice talking with you all.
The music in this podcast is entitled The Fifth Life by Circus Marcus.